As Wisconsinites get older, and the American Community Survey said 1 in 5 Wisconsin residents were over age 60 in 2013, more and more care of older residents is being provided by volunteer caregivers. Yet 55% of those caregivers report feeling overwhelmed by those tasks. To talk about the changing nature of caregiving and state and federal efforts to help caregivers, thanks to my left, Lisa Lampkins, Advocacy Director of AARP Wisconsin, Helen Marks-Dix, Associate State Director, AARP of Wisconsin, and Linda Marty Schmitz, who is a caregiver. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's make one thing. When we talk about family caregiving, let's get the definition out of the way. We're not talking about someone who is paid to provide care, correct?
We're talking about volunteers, and we're, you know, family members and people who are friends and neighbors, because an awful lot of people are helping other people, sometimes not even realizing they're caregivers, but we use family in the broadest sense of the word, people who are volunteering to help other people manage their lives at that point.
Is there a typical caregiver? Well, give us a little bit of your story.
I cared for my parents maybe a bit atypically, because for only a brief time were they living with me. It was just my mother. But my mother had Alzheimer's. My father had heart disease and prostate cancer.
Okay.
And the caregiving that I gave was some of what Helen talked about. Going down to the town they lived in, taking them to doctor's appointments, taking them to the hospital for whatever, taking them shopping, these sorts of things, until things got rather intense. And then I did some caregiving as far as they asked to go into a facility, got them into the facility, but it wasn't in the town in which they had lived their entire lives.
Okay.
And so I was there quite often. It was in the town that I lived in. And I was there quite often just trying to get them acclimated to their surroundings.
So you, Linda, you provided care for how long for your parents?
Well, if you want to talk about when Mom was first diagnosed, Dad had had heart problems for many years, but things got intense after Mom's diagnosis in 1999.
Okay.
So it would have been 9 years, because they both died in 2008.
Are you now providing caregiving to any family member, Linda?
No, thank God. But my husband's getting up there, so who knows?
Can you relate to that figure that Helen was good enough to give me? 55% of caregivers feel overwhelmed?
Yes. Since I no longer had my caregiving duties, I now moderate, facilitate a caregiver support group at the senior center in my town. And I hear this all the time.
Is there a average type of care that's being provided, and what type of care, and it goes for how long? Helen, you've got a pile of stats there.
I got a pile of stats here. So this is the most important thing I think, is that 46% of people who are doing caregiving now are actually providing nursing level caregiving. They're talking about medication management, they're doing wound care, they're doing intravenous feedings. It is incredible the amount of medical management that is being provided by caregivers that aren't necessarily well-trained or having medical backgrounds to do this.
46%?
46%.
Is that a national number?
Yes, that is a national number.
Are providing some type of nursing care that you just said they're not...
They're not necessarily trained to do it. That's one of the things. You go into this gradually. The first thing you know you do is you drive them to the pharmacy, and the next thing you know is you're setting up the medications for the week, and then the next thing you know you're looking at things like wound care, or you're looking at things like intravenous feedings or some kind of therapy regimes that people have given you some advice and some instructions for, but not necessarily the training you need. And people are very, very overwhelmed by it. Most of the people who do provide this kind of caregiving in their family often say they feel they have no choice. They learn to do these things because there's no one else to do it. There isn't, particularly for middle-income people, there's absolutely no programs. And so people get discharged from the hospital, they turn to their family members, and the family and friends cobble together the best they can a support system to keep the person in their homes, or even care for them in an assisted living facility, and eventually some type of institution. But most people want to stay home.
Lisa, thanks for your patience. So what have you learned working with caregivers?
Well, and I'll just sort of echo a little bit of what Helen said, in the sense that people are doing this because they want to keep people at home. They want to keep their loved ones at home. You know, people want to avoid nursing homes if they can. So it really is a labor of love what these family caregivers are doing. And the thing is, caregiving is becoming one of those family situations that if you haven't provided care in the past, you probably will at some point in your life. There are 40 million caregivers right now across this country. They're providing, get this, 37 billion hours worth of unpaid care. And if you try to put a value on that, the value of that is an estimated $470 billion worth of care that they're providing. And they're doing this out of love because they want to keep people at home and they're doing the very best they can. And they're often very anxious and afraid, oh my gosh, am I going to do all of these tasks right? Am I making the right decision?
The journalist in me wants to say, if they weren't providing this, this is a national number, Lisa,
correct,
$470 billion worth of care, who would be providing that care?
Right.
Well, you know, that's why we have all these fights about government programs. And as you know, in this last budget, we fought hard and long about family care. There really is no, for people with middle income, there is really no place to go. Long-term care insurance not only is too expensive, but the long-term care insurance companies are cutting back on their services because it didn't turn out to be such a good financial deal to do long-term care insurance. The poverty programs are really the poverty programs, and in many cases, we have in Wisconsin a good home-based community service program in family care, but in many states they don't. So the default is that people spend all their money, put people in institutions, spend all their money, then they become Medicaid eligible, and Medicaid will pay for a nursing home. In many states, it does not pay for home care. We're somewhat fortunate in Wisconsin, but that's still poverty level, and there isn't much for the average family until you spend all your money.
Well, you've seen the figures. Wisconsin is a state that's getting older than most of the rest of the nation. So this is an especially relevant issue for Wisconsin, right, Helen?
Right. And we do have, Lisa was talking about the national statistics. Here in Wisconsin, we have 578,000 unpaid caregivers, and the estimated value of the services they're providing is $7 billion. And that's just here in Wisconsin. So most of the care force in Wisconsin is an unpaid care force, not just an underpaid one, but an unpaid one, and an awful lot of people are taking care of each other. As we age, it's going to be more relevant for spouses or friends or older people to be taking care of older people because, quite frankly, there just aren't enough young people.
And I just want to chime into that because that is actually something that has a lot of people concerned. We always hear about those ratios in Social Security right there at the number of workers per beneficiary is declining.
Yes.
We're having and going to face a similar crisis when it comes even to family caregiving. In 2010, there were about 7 potential caregivers for every person in the country, age 80 and older. By 2030, that's going to be only 4 potential family caregivers. And by 2050, only 3 for every 1 person over the age of 80. So we really need to figure out how to manage that.
Well, Linda, I hope this didn't happen with your siblings, but you've heard stories. We've all heard stories of, I don't have the time. I live too far away to care for mom or dad. Thank you for doing it, or you just do it, and I don't care what you do. What are your thoughts on sometimes the rivalries? That's the wrong term. When one member of a family says, look, I just can't or won't, or I live too far away to provide for someone.
Yeah. Well, personally, I somewhat had that problem because by the time things came to the point where we really needed intense care, my brother, who was single, was working. My other brother was living in Illinois, as I told Helen earlier. However, I said, okay, I'll do what needs to be done, but when I say jump, you jump. And they were very good about that. However, through this caregiver support group that I'm facilitating,
yes,
I have heard some of the wildest stories you'd ever imagine about fighting about how to care,
yes,
fighting about how much money to pay for the care, and you know, from then on. So it is happening, and part of it probably is just because people have no idea what's involved in it if they're not right in it, you know, 24/7, day to day.
Which is another question I have. Are there training programs for caregivers? Especially, Helen, I want to go back to your stat if I have it right. 46% are providing some type of nursing care. Did you have to provide that, Linda, to your parents?
Luckily, I did not.
You did not. Are there training programs for caregivers?
Yes and no. There are some programs for caregivers having to deal with how to handle stress, about how to handle some of taking care of yourself. So there are some caregiver training like that and some training supports. Sometimes the disease organizations will provide some training for management of that particular disease process.
Unique to that disease only. Process. Excuse me.
And in some cases, hospitals or home health agencies that are going into the home will provide some training to make sure the medical gets done. But often the caregiver is left with being handed a piece of paper, often by the person that they need to provide the care for. This is what they gave me when I left the hospital.
Yes.
No instructions, no training, which is why the CARE Act is something that's important to us, because it looks to make sure that caregivers are given some training and the follow-up that has to be done for people.
CARE Act, is that a state initiative and a proposed bill, or is that the federal?
Well, I'm talking about the state. We're trying to, AARP nationally is trying to get the CARE Act passed in most states. We have it introduced here in Wisconsin as SB 19. And basically, it's an act that allows you, when you enter the hospital, to designate someone as a caregiver. And that allows them to get information. When that person is going to be discharged or moved to another facility, they have to inform the caregiver. And then when there's discharge and discharge planning, they have to help and train the caregiver to make sure they can adequately provide the care that needs to be done.
Now, in Wisconsin, it is Senate Bill 19.
Yes.
The lead sponsor is Senator Tim Carpenter, who we invited to join us, but we can't. Maybe it's because he just won a primary for a job on the Milwaukee Common Council. But the point is that viewers can go and look at that bill and maybe, if they like it, call it to the attention of their local senator or assembly member.
Yes.
I want to come back to Linda. Linda, you run a support caregiver group.
Mm-hmm.
How many people participate? And if they're attending your, how often do you meet and for how long? And here's my point. If the average caregiver, one in five provide 21 hours of care while they're working, mm-hmm. where are they finding the time to come to your support group, ma'am?
Our group meets from 3:30 to 5 on once a month. I had 8 people the last time.
Okay.
Now they're caring for different types of people, some with dementia. We had someone come in this time who was caring for someone who had rheumatoid arthritis that had gone to the extreme, was falling, this sort of thing. And all of them do not work.
Do not. Okay.
Well, wait a minute. The daughter of one person. There's 2 people that are pretty semi-regular that work, but they arrange their schedules so they can come to this event.
Do you have medical professionals come in to work people, to work with those attending your group,
if
giving
they would
advice?
Like, yes, right. This next time, we're going to watch the film that was put out by PBS called Caring for Mom and Dad.
Yeah.
And talk about that. As far as the, let's say, the manual things that need to be done, this group that I work with, it's mostly just to sit there and talk and know that you are not alone, that other people are going through the same stuff, or in my case, have gone through the same stuff that you have. The senior center at which I lead this group also has a group specifically for those who are coping with Parkinson's disease, and they just started one for MS, if I remember correctly. So they have the various, like Kellen was talking about, the various disease groups that get together. So, but they, I think, make time, some of them do, to be in on that. And then surprisingly, somewhat, those people who have lost the person for whom they are caring,
mm-hmm.
come back.
Okay.
Because it is a close-knit group. Becomes a close-knit group just because you're sitting there saying, oh yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Well, those must be very emotional sessions.
They can be.
People you love, family members, neighbors you've lived next to for 20, 25 years need care, and as their needs accelerate and get more pronounced, do some of the members of your care group feel, I just can't provide this level of care? Where should I turn?
Mm-hmm. There was one woman who was a registered nurse who kept coming and coming and said, I can take care of things. And about 3 weeks ago, realized that she couldn't. Her mother went into her facility and her mother died 2 weeks ago. Okay. So that does happen. And the thing we say is you have to look at what you're doing to yourself as well as what you're doing to help the person that you're assisting.
Lisa, thanks for your patience again. You work on federal issues. What's being offered at the federal in Washington, please?
Well, we're really thrilled to announce that there is a recognition that we need something at the federal level. And so just last week, Senator Tammy Baldwin, along with Senator Collins, who's a Republican from Maine, introduced the Bipartisan RAISE Act, which is Recognize, Assist, Include, Support, and Engage Caregivers. So it's the RAISE Act, which really says, hey, we've got a lot of people here who are struggling. There's, you know, financial difficulties, there's emotional, physical difficulties. We need a national long-term strategy to take a look at caregiving. And what we need to do is to bring together different people. So this RAISE Act would establish a national strategy. It would start with an advisory council. It would give them 18 months to basically come up with some kind of integrated recommendations, taking, you know, including caregivers, including people who are receiving care, including employers. You've got 60% of caregivers do work full-time, so the impact on employers is huge. It would include entrepreneurs, venture capitalists, you know, governments. We've got to take a look at caregiving across the whole spectrum. Some similar strategy has been pulled together for Alzheimer's, for example. So the RAISE Act is a huge step in saying, let's recognize that caregiving is impacting so many people.
Is this the first time that the RAISE Act has been introduced?
Yes, it is.
So it hasn't had a chance to really move forward in Congress?
Correct. It's just getting off the ground. But I encourage Wisconsin viewers to thank Senator Baldwin for her leadership on this because it's tremendous. Earlier this year, Congress, actually, there's a new caucus called the ACT Caucus, which is the Assisting Caregivers Today. So caregiving is new at the federal level, this whole notion of, hey, let's at least recognize that this is an important part of where people are at. And knowing that government can't solve the problem around caregiving, but can be the convener for all of the pieces to take a look at what can we do to support these caregivers.
Go ahead, Adam.
You know, we're talking about what's being done by the law and the government creating laws, but there's also some movement involved, like in Wisconsin, the Department of Health Services is doing a dementia-friendly communities initiative, which is to help communities be more friendly to people as they age, train restaurants and other places how to deal with somebody that if, you know, they're coming in, and just create a more supportive environment, both for the people who need care, but for the caregivers. One of the problems is I've talked to people who manage, you know, we talk about we need to get more money into respite to give caregivers time off or to give them a break or whatever. And I was talking to some people in northern Wisconsin, and they said, Helen, it isn't money that's the problem. We don't have people to do it. There just isn't the care force available beyond those volunteers, family members that we're currently using.
Well, having covered government, and you work on the federal issues, you work on state issues, the answer is often, we don't have the money for that. Is at the state level, the CARE Act, would that be a big ticket cost on the state spending?
There's no money at all involved for the state.
It is revenue neutral, Helen?
It's revenue neutral. And the feedback I'm getting is from the good hospitals who already train the people, you know, that train caregivers or do discharge planning with families to make sure they're adequately prepared. They say you don't need the law, and then the bad hospitals say it's going to cost us a gazillion dollars to train people. And then you run into some resistance sometimes from healthcare professionals who are a little horrified. They say to me, what do you mean you want to train people to do that? That's a nursing function. You should have a nurse in the house. And my answer is, how are you going to pay for the nurse? Yes, we'd love to be able to have healthcare professionals to do the medication management. Who's going to pay for it?
Well, Senator Carpenter's bill, SB 19, didn't get a hearing.
It hasn't gotten a hearing yet.
Now, Is that bad? Because where I'm going is, who opposes it? Is it for the the for-profit healthcare industry that opposes it?
No, I don't think that's where we're going to run into our opposition. I think it's more, you know, Senator Carpenter's bill hasn't gotten a hearing because we just came out of a budget session that was just unbelievable and nobody paid attention to anything else.
Okay.
And to be perfectly honest, I have not been up there bugging my Republican friends about being a sponsor on this because I was too busy making sure they were doing the right thing with long-term care and senior care.
Okay.
I think somewhat the delay is right now, you know, you have your Republican bills and your Democratic bills, and we have to get down to serious governing in the fall session. We just did the budget this last several
months. Lisa, at the federal level, what are you hearing in terms of opposition to the RAISE Act?
You know, very little so far. And in fact, there's been a very, very deliberate effort to make sure that all of the work on caregiving has been bipartisan. There is a huge recognition that, you know, regardless of your political affiliation, this is something that impacts people all over the country. And so at this point, there has been good movement. I mean, it's new at the federal level. So I think perhaps not even a lot of people have been paying attention to it opposition wise. But even the ACT caucus, they're both Republicans and Democrats. I've had some conversations in Republican offices for members of Congress who have said, yeah, you know, I've heard stories about this. I'm interested in this. Let us know what you're doing. So I think we have some good opportunity on this particular issue for some bipartisan work.
Well, Linda, let me ask you this. As someone who cared for your parents for X number of years, when you hear plans to help caregivers like yourself at either the state level or the federal level, what type of help should be given to caregivers like caregivers like you were providing for your parents?
Respite, helping to provide.
Now
respite.
Explain that.
That means the caregiver has, you know, 2 hours to get away from whatever they're doing.
Did you have any respite? Were you able to, when you were overwhelmed, did you have any respite white flags you could raise and get some help?
Yeah, mostly from family, though.
Okay.
Mostly from family. Although I do remember when Helen was talking about that there aren't people to do it in the rural areas. I grew up in Belleville, which is like 18 miles south of Madison. During one time, I wanted someone to come into my parents' home. My father was in the hospital. I wanted someone to stay with my mother, okay, for a couple days.
Yes.
And I found out, because I have worked in the aging network for quite a few years, I found out from somebody, yeah, we would qualify for some assistance in that regard. So I called an agency, two agencies, in fact, and said, okay, I need somebody to come down to Belleville, 18 miles from Madison, stay with my mother for a couple days. There's nobody who would even drive that far. So
is one thing that a federal or state government could do is provide some type of tax deduction for someone who drove the 18 miles to be respite care?
Mileage, whatever, you know. That would be very important, especially if you needed somebody, you know, who had the more professional knowledge of what needed to be done. I only needed someone to sit with my mother. As it turned out, it's a small town. I got somebody from the church to come over so I could, you know, get things taken care of and a couple of friends. So, and then there's just the whole emotional thing I talk about in our support groups. We've been there. We need you to know that what we're going through and to understand if we ask for help, we probably really, really need it right now. You can't tell me that I'll try and find somebody. You got to have a list and say, okay, they'll be there.
What about when the person who needs care, well, I'm going to use a specific family example. When my aunt in her 90s told my sister, no, I don't want you to call Meals on Wheels, what should be the response of someone who wants to be a caregiver, but the person who needs care is stubborn?
Well, I'm looking at my future there. I think that's really a very, very difficult one, because sometimes you have to put it back on them and say, how are you going to do it? because you can't rely. You know, my mother refused to hire someone to drive her because she thought I could do it and I could leave work all the time. And I finally had to say, Mom, I could pay this person $20 an hour to drive you around, or I can practice law and charge X number of hours, you know, dollars an hour. Do you really think it's a good use of my time? Why don't we have her do that, and then the time I spend with you can be more social, or we can go out and do things. But it's very hard, and you know, you really care for different kinds of people. There are people who, because of dementias or whatever, aren't aware of what's going on, so that you can make more autonomous decisions. But people who are have a level of cognitive function have a right to participate in their own decision making. So if they're willing to take the risks of staying home alone, even though it's driving the family crazy, it's a balancing act that the family has to negotiate, because the person whose care is being provided gets to say about how it's done.
Had my sister been at your care group and asked that question, you would have responded how, Linda?
I think we all would have shared our experiences, you know, as how we came about it. But I think what Helen says is, how are you going to do this yourself? I also think this may be a bit of a generational thing. My parents, Helen's mother, came from the greatest generation.
Yes.
You didn't ask for help. Right. You were within your family and stuff.
You're,
I think, those of us who are,
yes,
going into that time period more sooner than we thought, are going to know that you have to ask for help, partly because of what we've been through. Again, the dementia thing may throw everything off, but I think that that's going to be, we'll see that happening more. But then on the other hand, that's going to increase the need for caregivers if we're willing, as we get older, to say, yeah, get somebody in here to do this for us.
The other thing is, you know, I've often said our generation is going to go back to the ideas of communes and communal living before we go into institutions. I also think we're going to go back to bartered services and, like, okay, I can't drive, but you can drive, but you're not the best decision maker. So you do the driving, I'll do the thinking. Mm-hmm. I think there, and because of the lack of younger people, there is going to have to be some kind of pooling of our capacities to make it work by taking care of each other, because there's just not going to be a professional care force, and I'm not so sure there's going to be a younger volunteer care force. So it might be we are our own care force and have to figure out a way to help each other.
Go ahead, Lisa.
Well, the other thing I was going to say was, as being in that generation perhaps right below Helen and Linda, and thinking about my own parents and thinking about, you know, particularly in those generational shifts, when you look at now, the average caregiver is a 49-year-old woman.
Okay.
And she's generally working. I mean, you know, there was at one point in time where women weren't in the workforce as much and could provide that care. And now women are much more in the workforce. And so making sure that there's flexibility, not only in policies, but in a cultural shift too, that it's okay to provide caregiving, and that people need to recognize if somebody needs to hop out of the office for 2 hours in the middle of the day to go drive somebody, you know, that's the way it is. They'll make that work up at a different time.
The average caregiver is a 49-year-old woman. Person receiving care, average, male, female, and what age bracket? Or is that not a proper question? Because it's all over the map.
I think it's a 77-year-old woman.
77-year-old man, woman?
Woman. There are more women in need of care because we live longer.
That's true.
And most, I know there was a male support group for Alzheimer's here in Madison, but that was very unusual. It's usually women. The pecking order is women taking care of husbands, daughters taking care of parents, daughters-in-law taking care of parents, and then sons and male spouses get involved. Although in Linda's case, I think your father was a caregiver for your mother for a period of time.
Yes, yes. And again, that was the whole generational thing. I take care of her.
Yes.
You know.
Well, we talk generational things. Mm-hmm. Baby boomers, now between 50 and 69, will be getting to the point where they need care. What is the generational receptivity of Gen Xers and millennials to some of these caregiving needs? Do they not have time? Are they more willing to accept it? I realize I'm asking for a broad brush answer, but let's... No, Gen X and millennials, are they willing to accept a responsibility?
I actually think they are. I think there is a shift to a much greater, and I'm making huge sweeping generalizations here, but I think there's a shift to a much greater work-life balance, and that includes, hey, I'm going to do some kind of work, some kind of paid work that I'm going to get some fulfillment from. But maybe I do that and I only do it 30 hours a week, and I need some time to take care of kids, to take care of aging parents, to take care of, you know, a brother with a serious disease. Whatever that case may be, I think we've gone from, you know, those way overachiever days of everything was work, 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 and I can do it all.
All the type A's.
All the type A's and, you know, those, right, the kind of have-it-alls. I think people are... our younger people are more receptive to a little bit of that balance.
And I think they're starting younger, because our statistic shows that 1 in 4 workers over age 25 are already engaged in family caregiving of some type. So that means there are a lot of younger people who are already engaged in caregiving. We tend to, because we're 50 and older and we're AARP, we tend to think of older people, but there really is something that crosses generations.
Well,
one thing that we've that we've discovered, though, is that a lot of people don't identify as caregivers. Just because you take mom to the doctor doesn't mean that you're a caregiver. So that raises maybe a whole new set of issues. This Caring for Mom and Dad PBS program, there was a woman in La Crosse they interviewed who works at Gunderson, started taking the survey they had for caregivers and realized, oh my God, I'm a caregiver. Mm-hmm. And so that some of that is going to play out, I think, too.
You work on state issues, you work on federal issues. Are you more optimistic? Which level of government is more likely to act first, Washington or Madison? You go first, Helen.
I think that it depends on how you slice and dice it.
Right.
I think Wisconsin is more likely to act on dementia-related caregiving issues than general caregiving issues, because they've already shown an interest in the dementia-friendly communities. But coming up with a good, I would love to see a legislative study committee on what are the gaps in supporting caregivers and doing tax credits and doing, looking at our Family Medical Leave Act and having a really much broader discussion than just dementia. So I think we're likely to go first on dementia, but maybe not. I think the feds might go first on the broader issues of it's time to have a coherent policy on family care.
Lisa, I think she just said that people watching this show should lobby the state assembly and senators as opposed to members of the U.S. House and Senate, so I want to give you equal time. Are you?
Well, in some ways I do agree with Helen. I think, you know, states have often been seen to be the laboratories of things, and they can often get things done more quickly. However, you know, at the federal level right now, they're sort of looking for some things to work on, you know, on a bipartisan basis. And so I feel very good and very positive about some of the caregiver efforts federally, and think we could use a little push to get things done here at the state level.
You're optimistic about a federal government that can't
fund
highways any long-term meaningful ways.
Okay. It's my rose-colored glasses
I understand.
Today.
I commend you for that. We're almost out of time. Let's end the show this way. For some caregiver out there watching the show who is overwhelmed, specific advice, could each of you just speak to that person, caregiver? Linda, you want to go first?
Oh, yeah. I would say don't be afraid to ask.
Ask.
I mean, you're not in this alone.
Ask who? Call who?
Helen's got that answer. I was very lucky because of the Aging Network, but there are people who don't know where to go, but Helen has that answer. But don't be afraid to ask for whatever you need, whether it's, there are sources for money you probably don't know about, down to people who do a Share the Care program through their church or something. There is help.
And it's not wrong to say, I feel overwhelmed, I need help.
It's not wrong to admit that, no.
Ma'am.
And I am going to give you a website and a phone number. We have something called the Wisconsin Family Caregiver Support Programs, and they're coordinated through this website, which is www.wisconsincaregiver.org.
Okay. And all one word, www.wisconsincaregiver.org. Okay.
And the phone number is 1-866-843-9810. And they will get you, that's based in Milwaukee, but they will put you to your county, to your city, to your town. They are the resource of all caregiving services in Wisconsin. So if you only had one piece of information, that's the place to start. We do it at... AARP have a Wisconsin Caregiving Resource Guide that people can
get through your website?
If they go to our website, or if they go in and go ahead and send us an email that they can do through our website, we will send them copies.
What a quick follow-up. What about the county offices area on aging? Do they have resources like this?
Yes, all the aging and disability resource centers throughout the state, and there's one that serves every county of the state, have all of them have caregiving support groups. All of them have information about respite care. All of them have information about the support groups in your area.
Okay. Lisa, final question. Caregivers watching?
Yeah, the one thing I would say, particularly for caregivers who may be a little bit younger, is don't be afraid to be creative in how you use some of today's technology when it comes to caregiving. We had a coworker, for example, whose family was using a Fitbit to monitor activity. Okay, that's a cheap, inexpensive way to see, well, you know, how much physical activity are they getting? How much sleep are they getting? You know, be creative and really go online. AARP's website has some terrific resources and tips like that from people who are doing this in the trenches day in and day out. And sometimes if you can't make support groups, there are a wealth of resources online.
How many caregivers in Wisconsin?
578,000.
Well, let's end on that note. I want to thank Lisa Lampkins, Helen Marks-Dix, and Linda Marty Schmitz for coming in to talk about family caregiving. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.